Greetings and salutations to everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and it is my honor to welcome you to the annual and always outstanding and exciting Michelle Alpha Teleclass Lecture. This year, Dr. Alpha is presenting on water for reprocessing of medical devices, something that I've just learned is a very controversial topic, so I'm looking forward to this. If you go to the recordings library on our website and do a search for Alpha, you will be able to listen to six other Michelle Alpha Teleclass lectures from as far back as 2002. These recordings and handouts, they're available for free, and they get tens of thousands of hits every year. Dr. Michelle Alpha is not just one of my favorites. She is extremely popular as a conference speaker, as a research partner, and as a member of various committees. In fact, right this moment, she is in Berlin, Germany, to work on an international guideline committee. Dr. Alpha is from St. Boniface Hospital in Winnipeg, but her influence is worldwide. She is certainly not someone you easily forget. To give the presentation, Water for Reprocessing of Medical Devices, My Cup Runneth Over, But Is It Enough? From Hotel Spreebogen in Berlin, Germany, it is again my privilege to present and to welcome Dr. Michelle Alpha. Michelle.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. After that introduction, I'm sure I'm going to fall flat on my face and people will never forget what a disaster it was, but I appreciate your kind words. It's as I say, I was joking with Paul a bit earlier, and I was telling him that in a way it's good this is a teleconference so no one in the audience can throw rotten tomatoes at me, because sometimes this topic elicits heated discussion and frustration. I know myself, having been involved in some of the development of the guidance documents related to this, it's frustrating because we all know there's issues around it, but often there's very little direction given to us to help us make decisions about what to do. So I hope I can live up to Paul's glowing words. I'm sure that I won't be able to, but I do hope that you will take from this session a few aspects that will be useful to you in your own workplace and at least get you starting to think about, if you're not already well into the issue, regarding what the water quality should be for medical device reprocessing. The first slide that I've given to you, I noticed as I'm looking at it that typing is of course not my strength, because I have no one to blame but myself. I've typed the word reprocessing incorrectly, and maybe that's an indication of the truncation of what we do with reprocessing. But the first slide is really an introduction. If you could move to the second slide, I'd appreciate it. And the second slide indicates cleaning of medical devices, and I often use the adage, what you don't know can hurt you. Some of you who've heard me speak on medical device reprocessing may have seen this slide, but what I would like to draw your attention to is the center picture, which is the hub of a needle that is actually used for liposuction, and specifically it's used to aspirate fat from one part of the body, and then the fat is emulsified and then injected into the lip area to give our wonderful movie star quality lips. But what I'd like you to focus in on is the material that's in the very center portion. I hope you can notice that there's some little yellow bumpy stuff at the bottom in the inside of that hub. And this was an actual needle, a liposuction needle that was opened from its peel pouch. This device was ready to use on the next patient, and I don't think it will take you rocket science to realize that that yellow crud in the center is actually residual fat from a previous procedure. And basically, I think a picture is worth a million words, and the concept of cleaning of medical devices I think is really a significant one. And this is an example. I myself certainly wouldn't want a device like this used on me if I was having a surgical procedure. Now, some of the issues relating to the cleaning of medical devices have to do with the difficulty of the cleaning process, and some of them relate to the components that we use in that, and one of those is, of course, the water and the water quality. So keeping in mind that what you don't know can hurt you, my goal today is to try to discuss the issues around the water that's used in medical device reprocessing. So So if you can move to the second slide, it's interesting to me. I guess I'm old enough to have spanned enough years that you realize that the issues around medical procedures and device reprocessing have truly changed within my lifetime. And I think the basic tenet in all of healthcare is the first bullet on my slide, which is first, do no harm. And that is the tenet or the basic tenet that physicians function by. You want to help the patient and you want to make sure that what you do, if you choose to take an action, that the first thing is it's not going to do more harm than the patient had before you decided to take that approach with them. And I like to think of the 60s and the 70s as the age of Aquarius and free love, but the new millennium, I think, is the age of internet and litigation. And the reason I make that comparison is that for medical device reprocessing, there was a great deal of faith back in the early 60s and 70s that as long as you had a hospital process for cleaning, everything was good to go. And most or many of the surgical instruments were fairly straightforward, and that was probably not an invalid thought process. As time has progressed, we have gotten more and more complex instrumentation, and we have a public that is much more critical and demanding in terms of ensuring safety during some of their procedures. So although we used to accept simply having the use the typical cleaning process in a hospital, we're now realizing that that isn't good enough and that we need to give specific instructions on how to do the cleaning. And in addition, we also need to look at things like the quality of the water that's being used. So if you move to the next slide, I think it summarizes what the current challenges are, because it's not just one challenge. We have multiple ones. The device design and the manufacturer's validated cleaning instructions are a challenge because in many instances, some of the newer devices have been designed for the procedure and the physician's convenience and the ability to do the procedure, and they certainly weren't designed, or it appears that they weren't designed with the cleaning instructions in mind. The other issue that comes out here is there are also many devices for which there do not exist validated cleaning instructions, much less instructions on the quality of water that should be used in that process. So that is a challenge. The second one is obviously the competency of the personnel performing the reprocessing. And this isn't a statement or a criticism of the personnel. It's a criticism or a statement that relates to the institution's attention to making sure that the personnel either have the appropriate qualifications as a requirement for the position, and that they do get adequate and appropriate training for the devices they're reprocessing, and that that is maintained and assessed on an ongoing basis. We've all seen examples where Jim comes to join the department and gets trained by verbal training from Sue, who may well have no written instructions either, and is passing on her particular habits and thoughts about reprocessing as opposed to validated ones from a guidance document or from the manufacturer of that device. So I think the issue of reprocessing personnel competency is one that you're going to see in many of the new guidance documents coming out from both the United States and Canada, as well as from Europe. The third one, which is one that is just starting to come onto the horizon, or attention is starting to be paid to it, is the issue of water quality. And the question that I've posed in this slide is this really an issue that we need to pay attention to? Certainly, we have a lot of other issues that deserve a large portion of our attention, and here comes yet another one on the horizon. And that's why I made the statement, sometimes it's good not to be in front of a live audience, because you can see the frustration in them as they try to struggle with yet one more issue they have to contend with. So if you go to the next slide, what I'd like to start off with is the basics relating to cleaning of medical devices and identify really who is responsible for what. And I think it's important to recognize that the manufacturer is responsible to validate that the instrument can be reliably cleaned and sterilized and is therefore reusable. and that users also have responsibility, and their responsibility is to verify that on their site the cleaning equipment is working and that the in-hospital cleaning methods are consistently performed and that they're appropriate for the type of device being reprocessed. And I start here because sometimes it's overwhelming. Users get very frustrated because they see medical instruments coming through where they have no validated cleaning instructions, they have no idea of the water quality that should be used, and often this is because the manufacturers themselves have not in the past been required to actually validate the cleaning process. They have always been required to validate the sterilization process, but the cleaning has often been overlooked. And I think myself that sometimes the reason for this is that there is an assumption that if the device is going through a sterilization process, whatever's left after cleaning will be adequately dealt with by the sterilization process. And we all know that that isn't really true, and that that issue is becoming much more controversial recently when we start to pay attention to issues around cleaning. So if you go to the next slide, what I would like to do in today's series or seminar is really focus on the issue around water quality and what impact does the quality of water actually have on medical devices and or on patients. So I've divided it into two categories, if you will. The first that I would like to address is the issue on the impact of water quality in terms of the actual devices themselves. The idea that definitely there can be damage to the device, and this could include pitting, corrosion, loss of function. It also can contribute to the reduction in cleaning efficiency, because if the water quality isn't adequate, you're going to see that the cleaning provided by the washer disinfector or by the manual process is not going to be adequate to completely clean that device. And then the third bullet there is interference with disinfection or sterilization efficacy. A tenet has often been posed by people indicating if you can't clean it, you can't sterilize it. And I think that is a very good rule of thumb to use, because we all strive to do proper cleaning, because we know if the instrument is well cleaned, we have the best opportunity to then appropriately disinfect or sterilize that device. So I will touch on the water quality and how it impacts medical devices. And then the last part on that slide is the impact on the patient. What are the issues that relate to infection transmission, which is, of course, always a major concern when you're reprocessing medical devices? And one aspect, which is the last bullet on this slide, is the concept of it's not just infection transmission. Even if there are no viable organisms on an instrument, there may be residuals on it that can cause adverse reactions in patients. Certainly, foreign material can lead to inflammation and fever. And what I would like to share with you today is some aspects of those. We, myself included, we all tend to focus on, okay, let's make sure we're not transmitting microorganisms. But we often may overlook the fact that even if the device is sterile, i.e. there's no viable organisms there, that if there's residual material, organic material, it itself can have an adverse reaction in the patient. And I like the euphemistic term sterile crud, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about material that remains on the devices, and even though it may be sterile, there are issues associated with even residual material that has no organisms in it but may elicit an adverse reaction in the body if those instruments are used in the human body. So those are the two broad areas that I'm hoping to address in the seminar today on water quality. So if you go to the next slide, I would like to comment that the next few slides actually came from a colleague of mine who presented with me at the ISHEM conference recently, and these are pictures of the effect that water quality can have on discoloration of medical devices. So if you look at the far left picture, that's the inside of a washer disinfector unit, and you may be able to appreciate that the walls have definitely become discolored. if you look at the instruments, the surgical instruments shown in the center picture, again, you will notice discoloration. These are stainless steel devices that should be a nice, shiny stainless steel, and obviously they've become discolored. And the picture on the right shows an instrument case that also has become discolored. And in many instances, this is tracked back to the fact that the quality of the water that was used in the process contributed to the discolorization of these the material used inside the washer disinfector, the instruments, and the cases that some of these instruments are housed in. If you go to the next slide, this is again, these are examples of corrosion. Discolorization may simply be an aesthetic difference, but it could also contribute to difficulties in adequately cleaning those surfaces because, of course, the surface material may have been affected. But definitely when you start seeing corrosion, you know that that is going to have a major impact on your ability to clean these devices. The picture on the left is an example of a pair of scissors, and you can see the corroded components on those scissors. And the picture in the center is actually the port that was taken off of a flexible endoscope. And that particular port, you can notice, obviously there's very, very bad corrosion down the center portion of that port. In fact, looking at that port, it's hard to believe that it was allowed to get to that state before it was actually sent to the biomedical group for removal. But again, it's an example of corrosion on a portion of a device. And the picture on the far right-hand side is a hemostat or forcep type of, well, it's not a hemostat, it's a forcep. And you can notice again that on the lockbox part of the mechanism, you can see that there's corrosion that's occurring. Now, in all these instances, if there's visible corrosion, these would be the type of instruments that really should be removed and discarded because it's a well-known fact that once you get corrosion, your ability to clean that surface is very detrimentally affected. The issue in this particular case is what contribution to corrosion does the water quality that you're using in medical device reprocessing have on the likelihood that you're going to get corrosion or how quickly that corrosion actually occurs. One of the aspects of medical device reprocessing that I always like to emphasize is this is one of the reasons that we don't rinse materials in saline or salt solutions because obviously any of the salts that remain on that device could lead to corrosion. And certainly if devices are left wet, you can get corrosion that will occur as well. And in addition, depending on the quality of your water, you may have an effect on corrosion of your instrumentation. So if we go to the next slide, this is a very interesting one. And the impact on the devices, I've given you two examples of where you may have some level of damage or visible problem with the device. The picture that I'm showing you here is really quite interesting because this was an example. These are stainless steel panels, and there's three of them that I've shown in the picture there. And this was done by an industrial company looking at what effect the water quality had on the ability of their washer to actually clean these particular stainless steel carriers. And what they found, blood had been applied to these, and they found that when they used high purity water, the panel on the left, they got very good cleaning process. And the only difference with the other two panels was actually the hardness of the water that was actually used in this process. And what happened was that they got very poor cleaning, as you can see on the panel on the right, and that was with water that had very high water hardness in it. And you can see that exactly the same cleaner, exactly the same detergents were used, but the effect of the water quality certainly can impact on how well the cleaning is done. And we all know that if you have very hard water, your detergent that you've selected may or may not work in that level of water hardness. And if the detergent isn't working properly, you obviously are not going to get the cleaning that you expect from that process. So again, just an example, it's not a hypothetical example, it's a real example. The water quality definitely has an impact on how efficiently the cleaning process will be. The other thing that's affected is shown in the second bullet at the bottom of the slide. In washer disinfectors, depending on the water quality you've got, you can get effects that will lead to foaming. And that, if there's foaming, your washer disinfector may not work properly. And the usual, relationship is often the harder your water, the less likely it is to cause foaming. But the harder your water, the next bullet comes into play, where you can often get deposition or calcification and you get blocking of the spray jets. So I think many of you have probably seen examples of this. We all live with the idea that in a washer disinfector, one of the key things is to make sure that there still is water coming out of the spray jets, because if your water is quite hard, you often can get deposits that will lead to blockage of your spray jets. And then obviously, it's the fact that water's not even getting in properly that will affect your cleaning efficacy. So if we go to the next slide, one of the other aspects about water quality is the idea that in water, potable water that's delivered to our facilities, the quality of the water has been assessed as acceptable for potable uses at the site where the water treatment occurred. Subsequent to that, it is then basically distributed throughout the city to the healthcare facility, and then within the healthcare facility, it's distributed to the points where it is used, either in the washer disinfector or in any other tap in the facility. And one of the components of water that is of concern is the issue around water-associated microorganisms. Now, I've given you some nice pictures. The top four pictures, the one on the top left, which is a scanning EM picture, is an example of an E. coli or a coliform. The next small picture, which shows red dots on a greenish-blue background, is actually an acid fast stain showing you Cryptosporidium. The next shot is a cartoon representing Giardia, which is a parasite, and the fourth one that's there is showing you small round enteric viruses. Now, why I'm showing you these pictures and going through this is that we think that water is evaluated and assessed, and that potable water has no microorganisms in it. And I want to draw to your attention that in most countries, testing includes the organisms that I've put a box around. Certainly, fecal indicators and the coliforms are used as an indicator of fecal contamination. Those organisms are routinely tested as a quality assurance measure in water treatment plants. The other ones that often are evaluated for, not always, but most of the time, will be Cryptosporidium and Giardia. Again, the water is assessed to try to ensure that we don't have parasites such as these in the water that's being delivered to and used as drinking water in our homes. But the reality is that sometimes these two organisms are not tested for and can show up in the potable water. But what I really want to comment on is that all the other organisms underneath that red box, the enteric viruses, which you're seeing in the top series of pictures, as well as Pseudomonas, Legionella, and Mycobacteria, which I'm representing in the bottom three pictures, those types of organisms are not routinely evaluated in water treatment facilities. And the water that we get delivered to our homes certainly hasn't been assessed for those types of organisms. What the approach that is often taken is that we want to make sure that there's no fecal contamination in the water, and that's why the focus has been for many, many years on coliforms such as E. coli, and that is routinely done. But many of these other organisms like Pseudomonas, Legionella, and Mycobacteria can be found in potable water and certainly can colonize the delivery lines and pipes that are used to bring that water to healthcare facilities and to our homes. And I think it's important to recognize that just because the water is treated and is chlorinated and is assessed to ensure that it's considered potable doesn't mean there's no organisms in it. And I think that's an important aspect to keep in mind when we talk about the water quality used for medical device reprocessing. There are some stages in medical device reprocessing where potable water is perfectly acceptable. In fact, it is the way to go because, of course, it's expensive to have to treat your water if you are going to require special filtration or treatment processes, and it's much cheaper to be able to use potable water. And I'm going to walk through in a few slides later where potable water is perfectly acceptable, but even though it's acceptable, you must recognize that there are some places where it really is not acceptable, and one of the reasons is because there could be some of these other microorganisms in potable water, and we need to be cognizant of that. So water-associated microorganisms is something that is of concern in terms of the quality of water, depending on the type of medical device that's being reprocessed. So if we can go to the next slide, one of the concepts that I've just introduced is this idea of residuals that are left on medical devices once they are reprocessed and have been exposed to water. And so what are some of the residuals that could be on medical devices, and what impact could those have? What I'd like you to think about is that certainly medical devices can have contact with mucosal surfaces, and an example of a device that would definitely have contact with mucosal surface would be a flexible endoscope. And we all recognize that mucosal surfaces have microorganisms on them and that the medical devices passing over these mucosal surfaces are usually required to have high-level disinfection as a minimum. And that's in recognition of the fact that they're going to be contacting a surface that has microorganisms in it. But even for those surfaces, if there are residuals on the device that will elicit an inflammatory response, you can get damage to a mucosal surface. And a classic example of this would be if you were using a high-level disinfectant such as glutaraldehyde and you didn't properly rinse off the glutaraldehyde and it remained as a residual, it's been well described that that will cause mucosal damage, that there will basically be an inflammatory process that can occur on the mucosal surfaces. So even though the mucosal surface is quite robust and in a healthy individual is quite, not easily damaged, it can also be damaged by residuals on surfaces. The second bullet that's there is, of course, if you have a device that's going to come in contact with a sterile body site, that's an entirely different ballpark. Devices that go into a sterile body cavity, by definition, are usually considered to be critical by the Spalding classification, and they would require sterilization. One of the groups of instruments that I think is often in the gray zone, depending on the approach that's taken, are the MIS, or minimally invasive surgical accessory devices. These devices, like the scissors or retractors or graspers that will go in through a hole in the abdominal cavity, as an example, or as part of arthroscopic surgery, they do enter a sterile body cavity. And if there are residuals left on this type of instrument, of course, the effect on the body is going to be potentially can have a greater effect than if that same device was put in contact with the mucosal surface. Because in a sterile body site, you don't expect to have foreign material or residual crud on a device, and it could well elicit a stronger adverse reaction in the human body. And of course, if there's microorganisms there, you have a much higher risk of getting an infection from that than you would on a flexible endoscope coming in contact with the mucosal surface, because the mucosal surface has lots of microorganisms on it to begin with. Now, the third category that I've given you is the one that many of us have been in discussion with recently, and that is eye or ocular tissues. Any of the instrumentation used for cataract surgery or any invasive procedure in the eye is a very unique site. It doesn't have a lot of blood or vascularization blood vessels, and therefore any material that gets in there often can have a very, very damaging effect to the eye that results in a very destructive inflammatory response that the body has to the foreign material. And if you have a cataract surgery program in your institution, you're very well aware of the fact that this is currently a very controversial issue because there have been inflammatory responses that have led to people losing eyesight, and some of the issues around that pertain to the water quality used in device reprocessing. So these are examples of where residual materials on medical devices can come in contact with the human body, and I've ordered them in increasing order of magnitude in terms of the adverse reactions that can occur. So if you go to the next slide, I'm going to switch gears and talk a little bit about the complexity of the instrument design. And the next slide that I'm showing you shows you orthopedic instruments. And on the left-hand side are two examples of coiled reamer shafts, one which is a circular coil and the other which is a flat coil. But in both designs, you can see that when you torque them or bend them, which is what they're designed for, it doesn't take rocket science to realize that you could get body debris, blood, components of a bone, etc., wedged in between the coils. And the picture in the center, which is a test tube holding a swab, I hope you can appreciate the small chunk of black material. That was an example when we torqued a coil from a reamer that had been cleaned as best the reprocessing department could do. We used a swab to swab in between the coils, and you can see a chunk of crud that has come out. Now, the reason I'm putting this slide here is that Health Canada has had a scientific advisory panel involved in it for a number of many months, and one of the issues that's come up is trying to come to terms with the fact that many of the medical instruments that are currently being sold and used did not require validated cleaning instructions from the manufacturer before they were marketed in the U.S. or in Canada. And we're now starting to realize that some of the designs of these devices make it almost impossible to adequately clean them. And the example of the piece of crud is one of the areas of quote-unquote, okay, how significant is sterile crud inside the coils if indeed it's been adequately sterilized, which again I think cannot be relied on because we know if the piece of crud is thick enough, the steam, even steam, will not adequately penetrate it. And so the idea is to try to use devices like the one on the right. This is an example of a reamer that is a solid shaft design. And again, it doesn't take rocket science to realize that cleaning that type of device on the right is going to be much easier and much more effective than cleaning the device on the left. And so part of what we need to consider is the design of the instruments in terms of how easily they are cleaned, because some of the issues of residual are, of course, much greater with devices like the ones on the left compared to the device on the right. So if we go to the next slide, this is again another example of potentially where residual crud can occur. The picture on the far left-hand side is an example of a hand piece that's used in some of the orthopedic procedures. And this particular one happens to have a side panel, and the picture I'm showing you is the side panel removed. But what I'd like you to notice is all the crud and material that is built up underneath the edges of that side panel. And then what I'd like you to look at is the picture on the right. This is also an electronic handpiece that is made by the same company, but this particular design has no side panels on it. The picture on the right that I'm showing you is actually one that was used in a patient procedure, and it has not been cleaned. And it demonstrates that definitely these devices will be exposed to a lot of blood, bone, and debris, because that's the nature of the procedure that's being done. And the picture at the very bottom, again, are swabs that we use to scrape off some of the material from the handpiece on the left to demonstrate that, again, there's chunks of this material that, again, become residual on these devices. Now, the two slides that I've just shown you are not really related to things that happen because of the water quality that's used, but why they occur is because of the design of the device. So I think it's important to put into context that when we're talking about reprocessing of medical instruments, water quality is an issue, but another issue that is extremely important is obviously the device design. a well-designed device with validated cleaning instructions from the manufacturer is going to be one that we can more reliably reprocess regardless of water quality. And then as we consider how to clean it most appropriately, that's when the issues of water quality come into consideration. So if we go to the next slide, you can see I'm moving through the issues now, and what I'd like to talk about is what's the patient impact of water quality, and what can I do if in my facility, what can I do to address this? So what are the adverse patient impacts, and what steps do we need to take to ensure that adequate water quality is used for the medical devices being reprocessed in our center? And that's where I'm going to focus the rest of the attention for this talk. So if you go to the next slide, there have been some major new developments, and these developments are affecting all countries around the world. The discussion I've had up to this point about the difficulty of cleaning some of these surgical devices has become a major issue in many countries, and we are now starting to see guidance documents that require the device manufacturers to provide at least one manual and one automated validated cleaning protocol. It's not good enough anymore to say just use your routine hospital cleaning and leave it up to you as to what you use. It's important that the device manufacturers give us some specific instructions so we know if we follow them, we're going to get a clean device. So I think the first part is recognition that there's AAMI standards, there's ISO standards, and also Canadian CSA standards, which are an adaptation of the ISO 17664, that have all been put in place addressing the need to ensure that the manufacturer of medical devices give methods that are validated so that users can be assured that they can clean these devices. And the bottom part of this slide, I think, is probably one of the most important take-home messages. Users need to start giving pushback. We need to start refusing to order or pay for medical devices unless the manufacturer can provide us with validated cleaning protocols. And I think every one of you that's listening to this teleconference has probably had the experience where you've gotten a device that's been brought to the attention of your infection control or your reuse committee because of concerns regarding the ability to reprocess it. And often, it's not until it's in use that people realize that, oh, this is a problem. How are we going to clean this instrument? I remember years ago when I was asked to come into the reprocessing area of our operating room, and at that time we had minimally invasive laparoscopic devices that could not be disassembled, and they showed me where this device had been used on a patient. They'd done the best cleaning they could. They put it through the sonicator machine, they'd washed it with the appropriate detergents, etc., and then the person in the reprocessing area picked it up and tapped it on a white cloth, and you could see bloody material dripping out of the inner portion of the shaft. And that's an example of a design that prevented them from actually doing the proper cleaning. But the issue still remains. The manufacturer of that device had not provided cleaning instructions that were specific to the device that allowed it to be reliably cleaned. So I think it's important that as users we recognize it is a right that we have, that the manufacturers do need to supply us with the proper instructions that if we follow them, we can reliably clean these devices. And part of the manufacturer's instructions should include a statement about what water quality is actually needed. So if we go to the next slide, I put this one in here. You've probably all seen the money or seen the movie Show Me the Money. In healthcare, everything costs money. Every time you put another demand on the system, it costs money. So if we're talking about sterile crud, and there have been issues raised about acetabular reamers and electronic drill hand pieces, and there have been tests to show that despite the residual organic material that's in there, sometimes the pre-vac steam sterilizers are efficient enough to actually adequately disinfect these. So if there's no infection risk, what is the issue? And this whole bit about water quality is the least of our worries. You know, in the overall scheme of things, what's realistic and is there value to paying attention to things like water quality? Well, if you go to the next slide, I've touched on this already, but the residuals that can remain as a result of ineffective cleaning or rinsing would include things like foreign organic material. If you use a water sonicator that hasn't been adequately changed on a regular basis, they become bacterial cesspools, and that if they're left, if a sonicating water bath is left with water in it for several days and you're putting instruments in it repeatedly, it obviously, even though it might even not look bad, the reality is that there could be many microorganisms replicating, and every time you put a device in there, instead of cleaning it, you're actually coating it with more microorganisms. And whenever you have water microorganisms replicating, you certainly can have residual endotoxin, which is another word for LPS or lipopolysaccharide. This endotoxin or LPS is what comes from the cell wall of gram-negative bacteria. And even if the bacteria is dead, the endotoxin present in its cell wall can still cause an adverse reaction if it's put into the human body in a sterile body cavity. And then, of course, if there's blood or other organic debris, it could come from the previous patient, or it could even come from the cleaning process itself. The enzymatic detergents that we use in cleaning are actually protein solutions, and water organisms love those proteins. They actually will grow in the presence of the enzymatic detergent. They are certainly not killed by it, and if you leave them in enzymatics for long periods of time, they can replicate using the detergent as their food source. So the foreign material that's left there can cause an adverse effect, and the question is if it can get out of or off of the device into the patient. So what I'd like you to do is go to the next slide, and this is a publication that talks about one of the effects that can occur if something like sterol, and I mean there's no bacteria associated with this. This is purified LPS or endotoxin, which I mentioned comes from gram-negatives. This was a study that was done looking at implanting of stainless steel rods into, in this case, it was basically rats or mice that they were implanting them into. And what they were looking at is if they put a stainless steel rod into the femur of a rodent and there were no particles associated with it, that's the first bar that you see in blue, how well did it attach to the bone? So it's mimicking what would happen if you were to do a hip replacement and you had a rod or a stainless steel screw that was being used to hold the implant in place. And you'll see that in the time frame they chose to evaluate this in the animals, that 20%, if there was no particles associated with the rod that was implanted, there was attachment in 20% of the test animals. If, on the other hand, they also had clean polyethylene particles that were implanted at the same time that the stainless steel rod was, they did not get adequate take or attachment of that rod into the animal. And what I really want to draw your attention to are the next two bars on the graph where they had particles with LPS or lipopolysaccharide, and you can see that this is not an infection. But this has an impact because the stainless steel rod that was implanted into the test animal did not attach properly, and it was because there was LPS present. And you can see that the lowest level of attachment or take of the stainless steel rod occurs when you have things like LPS in the implant. And the reason for that is the LPS stimulates an inflammatory response in the host, and that prevents the implant from actually attaching properly into the bone. Now, if you think about that in the context of a hip replacement, you can see that if you're using things like orthopedic screws that actually might have LPS on the outside of them or other organic material, they are not going to attach properly, or there's the risk that if the inflammatory response against that residual material occurs, that implant is not going to take, and that patient will never have a joint that works properly. Now, many of you have seen the orthopedic trays, and you know that in many instances, the screws that are part of the implant trays come in many different sizes, and some of the sizes are not frequently used, and those instruments and those tray sets get reprocessed and exposed to the cleaning process of the washer disinfector every time that tray set is reprocessed. So there certainly is an opportunity if the water quality is poor, that those screws could have been exposed to residual exposures to things like endotoxin that might be present in the water. So this is an experimental example to show you that it's not an infection problem, but it is a problem related to organic material that might remain on an instrument that is either implanted or used in a surgical procedure. Now, if you go to the next slide, this slide addresses the issue of toxic anterior segment syndrome, or TAS, as the abbreviation is referred to. And currently, we have a number of outbreaks that have been described, and they're associated with cataract surgery, which is a very common procedure. And the problem occurs, it's early onset, usually within 12 to 24 hours of having had cataract surgery, the eye will become very inflamed, like the example I've given you in the upper right portion of the slide. It leads to pain, blurred vision, and corneal edema. And in some instances, this actually can lead to loss of vision in individuals that have a very severe inflammatory response. It is a non-infectious adverse event that occurs, and it's because the toxic agent, some toxic agent, is entering the anterior segment of the eye, and it causes an inflammatory reaction. Now, what is that toxic agent? There are a number of them, and any one of them can lead to TAS. If there's residual endotoxin, or LPS, and that can certainly come if you use a tap water rinse, or if there's residual organic material, such as an enzymatic detergent, that could be used in reprocessing of cataract surgery instruments, any of those residuals, whether it's LPS from the water in the tap water that was used to rinse that instrument, or residual enzymatic detergent, if that device is used on another patient, those components can cause this syndrome that's described here. So the issue here is the cleaning and rinsing with sterile distilled water is critical for ophthalmologic surgical instruments. And this is well recognized by the manufacturer of these instruments. And there's one reference, I've given it to you at the bottom of this slide. If you don't have it already and you do cataract surgery in your institution, you may want to get it. It's an excellent reference, and it's given by the Ophthalmologic Surgery Association, and it's the recommended practices for cleaning and sterilizing intraocular surgical instruments. It's an excellent reference, and it's a very current one that deals with this issue of what you need to be aware of if you have a cataract surgery program and you're reprocessing some of these instruments. Because if you if you're lucky in your facility, maybe nothing has happened because the water quality or the process that's used is adequate. But the reality is that it's very easy to get TAS develop, and being cognizant of the water quality is important. So that's TAS, and if you haven't heard of it, all you need to do is go and do a Google search for TASS, and you'll get lots of information on this problem. And as I say, the reference at the bottom of this slide is an excellent one to overview what the issues are. If we go to the next slide, the other one that there has been an alert put out about is the ultrasound transducer assemblies that are used for biopsying samples, prostatic biopsies. And the FDA has alerted sites that they really should use sterile water for rinsing or removing residual germicides from devices that have been processed. And the FDA is saying do not rinse reprocessed device with tap water because it may recontaminate the device. And these are devices that then are used to go into sterile body sites to get biopsies, and there have been actual infections associated with this. Now, you could argue that the infections are coming because the process that was used rinsed with tap water after the disinfection process, and that it's questionable whether the actual process that was used was an appropriate one, but I'm including this in here because it's, again, a current alert that has come out from the FDA, and it's regarding the idea that you do need to be careful about what you're doing your final rinsing with for many of these medical devices. So I hope I've given you a couple of examples that convince you that if you are doing some of these, you may need to pay very much attention to the quality of the water that you're using. Now, I've given you examples where there are problems. That doesn't mean that you can't use potable water. It simply means you need to be aware of what water quality to use for what type of device. So if we go to the next slide, it voices that. What to do. Just when you thought the water was safe and or you've maybe not really thought about the water quality in your facility, the question is, it seems rather daunting because you're getting water delivered to the site where you're doing your reprocessing, and what can we as users do about that at all anyway? So if you go to the next slide, one of the newest guidance documents, it's just been approved. It's not published yet, but it will be probably out for sale by AMI, I think, in early 2008. And this is the AMI TIR34, which is water for the reprocessing of medical devices. And I'll leave you to read the abstract that's there, but essentially it's probably one of the first guidance documents, and it's not a guidance document, it's actually a technical information report, that's why it's a TIR, but it's one of the first that addresses the issue of you can't or you need to think about what the water quality is for the type of device that you're reprocessing, and you need to be sure that the water quality is appropriate for the devices that you're reprocessing. So if we go to the next slide, and I think, if anything, I think this is one of the most important slides in my presentation. It took a lot of discussion and I think several years of work at the AMI committee to come to terms with what should we be doing in healthcare in terms of water quality. And I think this single slide outlines the four essential steps. And if there's one thing you take from my talk, it's that this would be a good thing to actually take back to your institution to look at. In some institutions, if you have dialysis water that's being used for dialysis purposes, or you have steam sterilizers and your facility is generating steam, in many instances the facility may have already looked at the water quality. They may not have, and the very first step in this procedure is really every healthcare institution really should do an assessment of their water quality. And what does that mean? That means that they should have a sample of all of the sources of water coming into their building to determine at minimum what is the water hardness that's coming into their facility, because we know very, very well that if you have very hard water, you need different detergents to ensure your cleaning is going to be done properly, and you may well have problems with calcification or blockage of jets and lines if you have hard water. If you happen to be in one of the geographic locations in North America that has wonderfully soft water, you may assess your water quality, and that may be all you need to do because you may have a water quality that's acceptable for all the different stages of reprocessing. But if you don't know what your water quality is, obviously you don't really know what you should be doing and whether there is a problem in terms of your medical device reprocessing. So the first stage that's important is an assessment of the water quality. The second stage is if your water quality isn't adequate, and I emphasize that because in some facilities the potable water may be perfectly acceptable, but if it isn't, you may need to implement water treatment processes. And that can only be determined if you assess the quality of the incoming water and you have your physical plant and your experts that deal with water treatment identify whether or not you really need a treatment process. The third step in the process is that you need to assure the proper water quality is being used for the various stages in medical device reprocessing. And I'm going to touch bases on a few of those in subsequent slides. And then the following step is you can't just implement, especially if you put a water treatment process in place, you can't just put it in place and then never monitor it and never know again whether or not the treatment is actually working properly or not. So the four essential steps really are steps that if you have actually had to have a water treatment process put in place, you should have done these steps anyway. But if you haven't, this is a very good outline of what should be done to assess, number one, what is the water quality in your particular facility? Do you need to do water treatment or not? And then if you do need to do water treatment, you need to assure that the proper water quality of the is used for the various stages of medical device reprocessing. That third step needs to be done even if you don't need to treat your water. And I've given you examples of where if you have an ocular cataract surgery program, you know, obviously you need to make sure that you're rinsing those devices with water quality that meets that standard of sterile distilled water. So you may not have a distillation process in your facility, which is fine, but you need to make sure that the last rinse is done with potentially bottled water that could meet that quality. And then finally, of course, if you are looking at water being used in these different processes, you really need to make sure there's ongoing monitoring so you know whether or not it continues to have the appropriate quality of treatment that you're expecting. So if we go to the next slide, the water quality document that's been put out by Amy, it's a saying, what are the big picture issues? The big picture issue is you need to do a water assessment and determine, is your tap water adequate or not? And you may or may not need to have water treatment. If you don't do your water assessment, you can never know whether the water quality is appropriate for use for medical device reprocessing. The second part of it, large stroke issue, is water quality for the various stages and types. And it took a long time for the committee to agree to it, but they've agreed to the fact that we should categorize water into four different categories or talk about them in that fashion because then we know what we're talking about. Tap water is the water that you get fed into your facility and is essentially potable water, and that's it. Softened water is, of course, your tap water that's been taken and it's been softened. Remembering that really softening doesn't change any of the characteristics of your incoming tap water. It just makes it softer by using salt being added to it to make it a softer water. So it will not have the issues with precipitates or calcium deposits because it's been as many because of it being softened. The other category of water that is there is there is deionized water, and you may know it as DI or the abbreviation for deionization. And what that is water where all the salts and solutes have been removed from the water so there's no ions in it. And what that means is, of course, chlorine, which is one of the components of normal tap water, is also removed by the deionization process. And you know just as well as I do that when you remove the chlorine from water, you then take away the component that keeps bacteria at bay. So of course, as soon as you deionize water, it becomes a great opportunity for organisms to replicate. So whenever you do treatment that involves deionization or any of the other more highly treated water, which would include deionization maybe followed by reverse osmosis or submicron filtration, any of those treated waters, you have to be very, very careful that your process is working well and that they don't become overgrown with microbes because that's a frequent occurrence as soon as you start deionizing or treating using reverse osmosis. You're taking the chlorine out and obviously the opportunity is higher for microorganisms to then be able to replicate and cause problems. If we go to the next slide, this is the first or a portion of the table, and really it is just to identify that for potable water, softened, deionized, and high purity, what portions of the process that it could actually be used for. And if you look at this, most of the potable water can be used for pre-cleaning, cleaning, etc. The only stage that sometimes it can be a problem for is for rinsing, particularly for critical devices. And you will see that what has been listed here is as your water quality increases, you get to the high purity water. Again, that high purity water is usually used for the rinsing, the final rinsing that's there. And the second row deals with primary uses for reprocessing methods. Remember, your potable water may be useful for almost all those stages, but you don't know unless you've done the testing. I am not going to reiterate it, but in the TIR, there is a table that identifies what level of hardness is an acceptable one for potable water and which levels of other organic or inorganics that you may need to be concerned about. So if we go to the next slide, the ongoing monitoring of water, what's the impact on device reprocessing personnel? And the committee looked at all of this, and I want to cut to the chase. You can have a look at this, but for bacteria, the agreement was that the only category of water that really need to have ongoing assessment for bacteria was high purity water. So you don't need to do water testing on potable water or softened water for bacteria because it doesn't make sense. You have no treatment process that is aimed at removing those organisms, and it's the high quality water that you really need to do that on. Endotoxin is basically the same. It's high purity water that needs that testing. Total organic carbon. All of those things are aimed at or tests that should only be done for high purity water. Now, for potable or softened water, monitoring the pH is something that is useful because that will give you an indication of whether or not there are problems with that water. And that's one of the few tests that people can do, reprocessing personnel, in addition to maintenance personnel. So the reprocessing personnel are not being held responsible to do all the monitoring. Maintenance personnel do much of it, but there are a few instances where the reprocessing personnel at their point of use probably need to do some of this monitoring, and the frequency is suggested. So if we go to the next slide, I just want to kind of summarize everything together. The first point, what is water quality? I think you need to understand that it is affected by the chemical content. If you have very hard water, you can have problems. It's also affected by the microbial content. If you have deionized or treated with reverse osmosis and you've never looked at your water and it's overgrown, you may have worse problems in treated water than you do with potable water because you haven't maintained the system properly. So you might have a high microbial content. And then the third one is if you have organic content left on your devices or in your water quality, it can lead to problems. The second blue bullet there is adverse effects. Do you see problems? Do you see rusting and spotting on your devices? Because it might be a reflection of the water quality that's being used in your institution. And are there inflammatory responses in some of the patients? Particularly TAS is one that if you get that problem, you need to think about the fact, what's the water quality that we're using in the device reprocessing? And I think basically one of the key things is the four basic steps, the idea of assessing your water, treating it if necessary, assuring and maintaining that you've got the water quality you want for the different stages in medical device reprocessing. And then I've listed at the bottom some of the common water qualities that are used. Potable, softened, and deionized are probably the most commonly used and available in healthcare. And the idea of highly treated water is very selectively used. So don't think that you have to go out and have RO water for everything. You don't. Potable water is perfectly acceptable for many of the stages. And then finally, monitoring the water quality, particularly if you are treating it, is very important. So the last slide I've got there is that water issues aren't all bad, but I think we need to recognize that we need to know what our water quality is in order to know how to deal with it. And I'll stop on that note. I was hoping to get through a little faster than I did. I would highly recommend some of the references I've got at the bottoms of my slide are useful ones, and that when the TIR does come out, it will be, I think, a useful document to help us walk through this process. So thank you, and I'll stop at that point.
Well, thank you very much, Michelle, for another fantastic teleclass. We can always count on you to present excellent information in an elegant way. I'm really pleased to announce that we, in fact, have already booked you for next December, so I'm glad that you'll be joining us again, and I thank you very much for this teleclass. Thank you all for joining me on this teleclass. A special thanks again to you, Michelle, for what you gave to us today. We'll talk again soon. Goodbye.